You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, we look back at the top foundational physics stories of 2012.
Well, does that mean that things like the newly discovered Earth-mass planet around Alpha Centauri, does that mean that it didn't exist until we looked at it? And I had a very serious physicist say, yes, that is exactly what it means.
Could a multiverse of parallel universes, predicted to exist by string theory, explain why time flows in only one direction?
The problem with the era of time is to understand why the early universe was so incredibly ordered. That's the mystery.
And does space-time break down at the fundamental level?
In emergent space-time theories, you don't put that in. You say, I'm not going to assume that space exists. I'm going to put in a whole bunch of other kind of mathematical objects, none of which are geometrical, and I'm going to see whether geometry as we know it can emerge out of that mathematically.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali.
We have to begin this month's podcast with news about the winners of the FQXI essay contest. This year, we asked entrants to muse about whether any of our basic physical assumptions are wrong. So, Brendan, tell us about the winners and their efforts to rewrite physics.
Well, the $10,000 winner of the first prize in the FQXI essay contest is Rob Speckens from Perimeter Institute of Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Canada. The contest this year asks, which of our physical assumptions are wrong? Rob said we should consider, or reconsider, the usual distinction between the kinematics of a thing, sort of the static nuts and bolts of which it exists, and the dynamics, or the way in which the system actually evolves. Or to put it another way, between the possible states of the system and the equations that describe how the states transform. Rob suggested in his essay that we could unify these concepts through causality, similar to how relativity unifies space and time. We also had two second prize winners, George Ellis from University of Cape Town in South Africa, and Stephen Weinstein, also from Perimeter Institute and the University of Waterloo. George Ellis challenged the belief that physics can ultimately describe everything in terms of a simple unifying theory. He pointed out that there are well-known examples from biology, like the way the brain works, where a complex system can't be broken down into simpler fundamental parts. And he gives a lot of possible top-down examples from physics. Steve Weinstein asked whether what happens at one point in space is really as independent as we think from what happens at other points in space. He suggested that changing our views might solve a lot of the puzzles we have in physics at the microscopic level and the cosmological level. We had almost 20 other prize winners, including one from Angelo Bassi, Tejinder Singh, and Hendrik Albrecht, who you can listen to in our November podcast, where they talk about their latest experiments looking for the boundary of the quantum world. So run to the website where you can read all the winning entries, along with all the other great essays that didn't win a prize. That's www.fqxi.org/community.
You can also read a winning entry from last year's FQXI essay contest. That was the one that asked whether reality was digital or analog, by David Tong in the December issue of Scientific American. The essay contest was certainly a highlight of 2012 for us, but what other physics stories hit the headlines over the past 12 months? Since the end of the year beckons, I invited FQXI member Ian Durham, a quantum physicist at St. Alnson's College, New Hampshire, and another of this year's essay contest winners, to run through what he thinks have been the top four foundational physics highlights of 2012. I spoke with Ian earlier, and in the first part of our chat, I asked him to reveal the physics stories that take the fourth and third spots on his countdown. First of all, congratulations, Ian Durham, on your award-winning FQXI essay.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It was a pleasant surprise. Nice Christmas present, actually.
And thank you for talking to us today and running through your sort of highlights from the world of foundational physics in 2012.
My pleasure. I'm on sabbatical this semester, so it's always nice to actually talk to someone.
So your fourth pick of the year is something, it's quite abstract, it's quite theoretical, and it's to do with the foundations of quantum mechanics. So can you explain a little bit about what you've chosen?
Sure. I've chosen a paper by Matt Pusey, John Barrett, and Terry Rudolph that's been known since they put it out as the PBR paper due to their last names. And it has the rather strange title that the quantum state cannot be interpreted statistically. And I should probably give a little background because this is kind of technical and a little out there. But quantum states, so when we have physical systems, we usually describe them as being in a particular state. And the quantum state has been debated for, well, quite nearly 100 years now, not quite, but almost, about what it is. Specifically, a quantum state is described by something called a wave function.
So this is trying to get to this sort of the central point of quantum mechanics, which is that, you know, before you measure a system, you don't really know what state it's in, and it's not really even in a set state. It's in sort of a superposition of different states. And the wave function is kind of a mathematical description of the probability of finding it in some kind of state. Is that a way to put it?
That's one way to put it. I think there's debate about that, and that's kind of what this paper is a little bit about. The wave function is the mathematical description both before and after measurement. So the question is, what is the wave function? What is the quantum state? The two words that tend to be used are epistemic and ontic. So epistemic would mean that it's a state of knowledge, whereas ontic means that it's a state of reality. And Matt Liefer, who's another FQXI member and who has a really nice blog, mattliefer.info, he sort of described three different camps of belief in the wave function. There are those who think that it's epistemic, meaning that the wave function describes a state of knowledge. It's what we know about the system. It doesn't necessarily describe reality. But that then there is some underlying reality beneath it. There is an underlying ontic state. So there's an ontic state, and then the wave function is the epistemic state on top of that. That's one camp. Then there are those people who are pure epistemists. They say the quantum state is the epistemic state, and that's it. There's no underlying reality in the sense that if a tree falls in the quantum forest and no one's there to hear it, these guys would say the quantum forest doesn't even exist. Unless someone is there to make a measurement, the thing doesn't exist. So, and I actually have had serious people who've said this to me at various times. I would say that to them, I'd say, well, does that mean that things like the newly discovered Earth-massed planet around Alpha Centauri, does that mean that it didn't exist until we looked at it? And I had a very serious physicist, quantum physicist, who has a respectable, non-crazy guy say, yes. That is exactly what it means. So that's the second group of people. They really don't believe anything exists until you look at it. Then there are the third people that say the wave functions are ontic. They're states of reality. So a wave function is a real thing. And I would guess that most field theorists probably fall in this category. So your particle physicists and your field theorists, people who believe that fields, those who believe that those things are real, actual things, and that it's not just information, those are the folks who fall into that category. So those are the sort of the three options. So the PBR paper, though, essentially tries to rule out camp number one and says that if you believe that there is some underlying ontic state, then you really ought to believe that wave functions are ontic to begin with. In other words, if you believe that there is some underlying reality, then you ought to believe that the wave function itself is reality and is not just statistical.
Does this paper have any practical implications, or is this something that's really purely theoretical? Or, you know, would this make any difference to things that we could build in the future or experiments we could do?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. And my gut reaction is to say, nah, this doesn't have anything to do with practical results. But I also happen to be an engineer, and thinking long and hard about this down the road, I think it does have some important implications for practical technology, assuming humanity doesn't obliterate itself before it reaches that point. But I think the people who are in camp number one, the ones who believe it's a state of knowledge but are looking for hidden ontologies, the whole question is whether or not they should even be doing that to begin with. Because is it really just philosophy or not? And because you never know what kind of technologies will come out of these fundamental physical problems. I mean, nobody thought quantum mechanics was terribly useful when it first came out. And here it is, it's used every day in all sorts of things. So the question is, if we don't look for hidden ontologies, and will we necessarily miss something that could give us something practical down the road? And so I think in that sense, the PBR paper is important because it does imply that there are certain approaches that probably shouldn't be taken, or shows that they can't really be taken.
Well, talking about the practical applications of quantum phenomena, I think that's leading us towards your number three top story of 2012. So please tell us what that is.
Indeed. So that's the Nobel Prize in Physics this year, which surprisingly, not totally surprisingly, but a little, it surprised some of the people who predict these sorts of things, went to Serge Haroche and Dave Wineland for actually figuring out a way to manipulate individual quantum particles. Way back in the founding of quantum mechanics, I believe it was Schrödinger who said that no such thing was even possible. I have a quote. Schrödinger said, "In the first place, it is fair to state that we are not experimenting with single particles any more than we can raise ichthyosauria in the zoo." Schrödinger wrote that in 1952. Because I think people really believed it was a statistical theory, and that on an experimental level, we couldn't actually manipulate individual particles, like a single electron or a single photon. But Haroche and Wineland have, using slightly different methods, been able to do that. And what that has helped pave the way for is practical applications of quantum computing in particular, where we can actually individually manipulate single quanta so that we can use them as bits or qubits instead of classical bits. In particular, the details of it is that Dave Wineland, he does a lot of work with ion traps. And what they do is, using lasers, they take an ion, which is basically an atom that has electrons stripped off of it. So it has a net positive charge. And they basically shine a lot of lasers on it from a lot of different directions and get it to pretty much stay still so that you can then move it around. You can change the spin and do other things to it to change the state. And Serge Haroche has done similar things, but he sort of approached it from a slightly different standpoint. He was doing a lot of work with photons, and in fact was part of a team that realized the first two-photon micromaser. So a maser is like a laser, but in microwaves. And just to give you an idea, it's very hard to isolate a microwave photon because you're starting to get into longer wavelengths. A photon is a naturally localized particle. Well, when you get into microwave, you're starting to get into things with long wavelengths where it's kind of hard to say it's actually localized. And what Serge Haroche's team has done was essentially develop microwave cavities and has performed similar tasks to what Dave's group has done, but using what's called cavity QED. So it's a slightly different way of looking at the similar kind of problem.
Now, you mentioned that it was sort of a surprise to some of the people that were trying to predict what was going to win the Nobel Prize in Physics this year. Is it just because, like you sort of said, people didn't expect that experimenters would be able to actually manipulate these states? Or is it also that, you know, you wouldn't perhaps have expected this particular discipline to be recognized at this point in time?
I think it's the latter. Although Thomson Reuters, there's a guy who works for Thomson Reuters who sort of makes a business of predicting these things. But he did predict it would be somebody from the Quantum Foundation's quantum information community. He predicted Charlie Bennett, Gilles Brossard, and Bill Wooters.
Just to clarify that, the prediction that you were talking about for sort of Bennett and co. was for their work on quantum teleportation.
Yes, and I was personally rooting for them because I know Charlie and Bill, and I just spent some time with Bill this summer, and Bill works at a small liberal arts college like I do, so it would be neat to have somebody on that level win. But I have to say, since I work in quantum information in addition to foundations, we were quite elated because it's the first Nobel Prize that specifically, not in the official citation, but somewhere in the write-up, the Nobel Committee actually mentioned quantum computing. So I think that's what was surprising, especially with certainly the pundits were expecting the Higgs to win this year.
So, quantum physics takes both fourth and third places on Ian's list. Later in this podcast, we'll rejoin Ian to find out which physics stories have earned the top two places.
You know, listening to that rundown, I'm already feeling nostalgic for the soon-to-depart 2012. I wish we could turn back the clock and experience some of those events all over again.
Sadly, we just can't do that, Brendan, because, of course, the arrow of time only points in one direction, forwards. Just why we're forced to march from the past to the future and cannot backtrack has been a big mystery for physicists for years. But Raphael Busso, a string theorist at the University of California, Berkeley, thinks the answer to this problem of time may lie in the multiverse. The idea that our universe is one of many parallel neighbouring universes, as he explained to reporter Sophie Hebden.
String theory posits that matter is ultimately comprised of tiny vibrating threads of energy. Raphael Busso, who is based at the University of California, Berkeley, has contributed to the theory's development, particularly in what it can predict about the history and structure of the universe, cosmology. I caught up with him to ask about the progress he's made on using string theory to understand cosmology. Or is he using cosmology to rule out string theory? I'm getting all tied up here. What exactly is string theory? And what does it have to do with cosmology?
It wasn't invented for the purpose of understanding quantum gravity. It wasn't invented as a unified theory of everything, which is certainly how I think about it now. It was invented as... not even as a theory, it was invented as some formula that somebody wrote down, which was supposed to help us understand the physics of the strong interaction, quarks, protons, neutrons, things like that, way back in the 60s. And it took on its own dynamics. It's turned out that this formula can be understood by thinking about strings interacting instead of point-like particles interacting with each other. The mathematical structure that had been uncovered was so rigid and so rich that one thing just kind of led to another without much choice about it.
Along with string theorist Joe Polchinski at the University of California, Santa Barbara, Busso has played an important role in unraveling some of string theory's problems.
You may have heard of the fact that string theory has too many dimensions. It has 9 spatial dimensions, and we see only 3, and that used to be viewed as a sort of embarrassment. Because you then have to say, okay, well, 6 of them must be very small so that we don't see them. They're curled up in, you know, on scales that are not accessible even in the best microscopes or particle accelerators we have. And that's perfectly possible, but it wasn't really doing that much for us. It was more like something that we had to say in order to not have a contradiction. One thing that we discovered in string theory, and Joe Polchinski and I played a role in that discovery in the year 2000, is that there isn't just one way of getting rid of the 6 extra dimensions. There's a huge number of different ways of doing that. And they all lead to three-dimensional worlds, but the three-dimensional worlds look a little bit different, sort of the way the laws of physics look different in air and in water. Fundamentally, they're the same, but there's certain effective laws that are different. And it led to this picture of what's called the landscape of string theory, where there are many different ways in which you could have made the three-dimensional world, but and we just happen to be one realization of that. And that, in turn, this idea that there might be many different, what we call vacua, or different ways of making empty three-dimensional space, that has some impact on how we might think about the arrow of time.
So the idea of your vacua, are they sort of pockets of universes, would you say?
So there's sort of two ways of thinking about them. One is as different states in the theory. So if I give you the standard model of particle physics, you know, electrons, photons, and so on, you know that you can build water molecules out of those particles. These are sort of possibilities that are built into the theory. Another question is the actual phenomenology. do these things dynamically get made? There are many things that we could, in principle, build out of electrons and quarks and photons that didn't get made in the real universe because of the way the dynamics played out. For example, there are materials that we created in labs which never were created in any natural processes. And there are many other imaginable materials that have never been created. So there are these different ways of making three-dimensional space which are built into string theory as possibilities. The same way that water and air and iron and so on are built as possibilities into the standard model of particle physics. And then cosmological dynamics decides which of these things are actually made, in this case, which of the three-dimensional worlds are produced, how abundantly they're produced in different parts of the universe, and so on. And that dynamics leads to something called the multiverse. It's really not such a good name because it makes it sound much more mysterious, like sort of disconnected universes. It's more like, you know, you have a tank of air, you have a tank of water, they're separated by glass. It's no more not much more mysterious than that anyway.
The prediction from string theory of the existence of a multiverse, that there are billions and billions of different universes called vacua, each of which has different particles and different forces, provides an explanation for the precise value of a fundamental constant in our own vacua. This number is incredibly tiny. It's 0.00, and keep writing zeros until you have gone 120 places after the decimal point, and is known as the cosmological constant. It repulses gravity and allows space-time to expand faster and faster. Astronomers measured this accelerating expansion in the late 1990s, and the cause of it has been dubbed dark energy. But it has been difficult for theoretical physicists to explain why, if dark energy is due to the cosmological constant, it has the precise value that it does. The cosmological constant we measure seems to be just large enough to give rise to an expanding universe that allows observers, like you and me, to evolve. A larger value for the cosmological constant would rip matter in the early universe apart, so fast that stars and galaxies could never have formed. It seems like a remarkable coincidence that our universe is so perfectly tailored for us to exist, but string theory has a simple solution. If we accept that there are many vacua in the landscape of possibilities predicted by string theory, then some will, by the laws of probability, have a cosmological constant of the size we see. So, there's nothing particularly special about that value at all. We should expect to measure a small cosmological constant, because life would only be able to evolve in one such corner of the landscape. That prediction was a major success for string theory.
String theory, in my view, is the only game in town that has provided a reasonable explanation of that number. That does not mean that it's necessarily right. But until a comparable or better idea comes along, I think it goes on the list of things that should make us take string theory very seriously. Particular this aspect of string theory, can it help us understand cosmology better? Can we use cosmology to rule out string theory or to rule out how we currently understand string theory? So I think that's where I see my work. I don't think that there should be any sort of ideological view there that, you know, I somehow like string theory and it has to be correct and I have to fit it onto the universe. It's more the other way around. I think it's there aren't that many theories that have a chance of being a consistent theory of quantum gravity that have, you know, passed so many consistency checks that are so rich and which are also now starting to make contact with observation, in particular the acceleration of the universe, which we have, again, no other explanation for.
The idea that there are many vacua may also impact how we think about the arrow of time, this idea that time progresses from the past into the future.
You know, subjectively, of course, we experience an era of time. We remember the past. We don't remember the future. We try to predict the future, but with limited success most of the time. Why is this? The first guess might be this asymmetry comes from an asymmetry in the laws of nature that perhaps things simply evolve differently if I run the film forward than if I run the film backward. And very often it does seem that way. If you spill a glass of milk, and, you know, you film that on video and then you run the video backwards, you can immediately tell that that video is running backwards as the milk collects itself and the glass, you know, puts itself back together. But at the same time, if you really dig more deeply at the underlying laws of physics, they're actually completely time symmetric. There's nothing going on at the microscopic level, which is in any way different as you run things into the future or into the past. And so what is it then that makes it possible to understand, to see right away that the film is running the wrong way? It has to do with disorder. It has to do with what physicists call entropy. See that entropy or disorder increases towards the future, but not towards the past. The state where the glass is broken, the milk is spilled, is much more disorderly in a very specific mathematical sense, in that there are many more ways you could arrange all the microscopic pieces, the atoms and molecules, into a state of broken milk glass than ways in which you can arrange them into a state that we would call an intact glass of milk. And the problem with the era of time is to understand why it is that disorder is increasing only in one direction. Because if you picked a random state of the universe and you asked, okay, suppose it's not maximally disordered, what's going to happen? Well, if you run it towards the future, it will get more disordered. This is called the second law of thermodynamics. If you ran it towards the past with a big computer, you would also find that it would get more disordered, unless it was a very special kind of state that came from an even more ordered state in the past. And that's the kind of universe that we live in. And so the era of time problem used to be understanding why, well, it still is at some level, it's understanding why the early universe was so incredibly ordered, so that, you know, 13.7 billion years later, we still see disorder increasing, not having reached the maximum. We still see an era of time. That's the mystery. How come that there was so much order in the early universe?
What Busso came to realize, through work with colleagues in 2002, is that the problem of the arrow of time depends on what sort of vacua the theory has, such as how many there are, what cosmological constant each has, and how they are connected to each other. He has been exploring this further with his FQXI grant of $100,000.
What I've been thinking about since I got this grant is sort of the other side of the same coin. It turns out, as I found, that it also goes the other way. So what can happen if the vacua of your theory, if there's more than one vacua, I mean, these vacua are arranged in just the right way, it is actually possible to start the universe out very, very disordered, much more disordered than it is today, and yet still get an error of time. That's an interesting new result, which I think was not fully appreciated before. Now, the way that you start out with very large entropy is you would start out in a different vacuum, which admits higher disorder than our vacuum overall. And it is possible in some ways of arranging the vacua, and string theory seems to arrange them that way, so that's where things connect up with the string landscape. It's possible that there's no way to get to any vacua that contain observers like ours without first going sort of through a bottleneck of extremely highly ordered states. And so even though you started very disorderly, even more disordered than the universe is now, you can't get to any kind of universe that's actually observed by anybody without first creating a lot of order. That's kind of the key result here. So it means that, you know, depending on the structure of the vacuum, on how many ways there are to make three-dimensional space and how they're arranged in the theory, it is not necessary nor is it sufficient to start with a highly ordered state in order to explain the error of time. You can have situations where high order doesn't help you, and you can even have situations where high order isn't necessary and you nevertheless get an error of time.
Vacua changing state is called vacuum decay. One type of vacuum can decay to a neighbouring vacuum. In other words, one type of universe can turn into another with different laws, except that it doesn't affect all of space at the same time. It's a bit like water boiling, in which a bubble of steam forms and expands.
You have bubbles within bubbles. They all expand very large. And the question is, on the way to where we are now, so there's a decay chain of vacua. And the question is, did you have to go through a vacuum that is very highly ordered in order to get to a vacuum like ours that has observers in it? Some landscapes and some ways of arranging the vacua, that is in fact the case. One thing that I've been trying to understand with a student, actually, is how sensitive this result is to situations where the initial state is not in just purely one vacuum, but might be distributed in a sort of probabilistic way over several different vacua. And what we're finding is that the result is robust in the sense of being able to accommodate plausible initial conditions that we believe the multiverse dynamics leads us to, but not necessarily all possible initial conditions. You know, it's really still ongoing work, and the implications of this result, that you don't necessarily need a highly ordered initial state, are still being worked out, and my group here is, you know, among the people working on this.
So can you just eliminate Big Bang cosmology with your string theory?
You're right. You see, the Big Bang was always a placeholder. I mean, Big Bang cosmology is used in usually just in the sense of saying, well, the early universe was hot and dense and expanded. And then, you know, from that, from those few words, if you put those together with what we know about particle physics, you can explain an enormous number of facts about the universe to incredible quantitative precision. And that's very, very beautiful. But it doesn't mean that you actually know what the Big Bang is. If you run it all the way back, well, you know, maybe there was a period of inflation. We don't know what preceded that. And so if you don't think there was inflation, you would run into a singularity. You don't really believe that, you know, a singularity is a physical thing. It should have some resolution. We should understand what that really means. The story that I just told you about vacua decaying into other vacua simply gives you a longer prequel to what we call the early universe.
Thank you to Raphael Busso for talking to Sophie Hebden. You can learn more about his research in an article and video on our website, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
And now back to Ian Durham's countdown of the top physics stories of 2012, as he and Zia discuss what takes second place on his list, and, well, this could be a surprise.
Right, now we come into your number two big story of the year, which you've already kind of touched on, and I think it might be surprising to people what number two is here, so go ahead.
It's the Higgs.
It's the Higgs.
I felt, you know, we had to put the Higgs in there somewhere. So, of course, late last year, 2011, there were some results that came out of the LHC that suggested that they perhaps had found evidence of the Higgs. It was funny, last year at this time, when they had the initial results, I believe they were correct to within, was it 3 sigma or 5 sigma, something like that. And the biologists all laughed and said, well, geez, you know, that's dead on correct when if you're a biologist. And of course, the particle physicists said, yeah, but, you know, 50% of the time in particle physics, a result like that is wrong. So they had to do some additional work, which was done. And this summer, they released some additional data that supposedly confirms that the Higgs exists. And, you know, there's still some additional work that needs to be done to really nail it down. But I think it's pretty evident that, yes, the Higgs does exist. I will say there are some funny things. It was a little anticlimactic. You know, physicists really like it when new physics comes about. And people thought, well, wouldn't it be great if the Higgs didn't exist? You know, the Higgs existing is essentially confirmation of the standard model of particle physics. When we make discoveries that merely confirm previous models, sometimes it's a little ho-hum. Now, what's very interesting, there are two things I wanted to mention in relation to this, because I have a psychologist friend who finds this whole concept rather amusing, that we have these reams and reams of data that, you know, you have to manipulate it and move it around just in the right way in order to tease out this little bit of data that says, oh yeah, there's actually a particle there. And he says, wow, that's just weird on so many psychological levels. And I said that it confirmed the standard model. Well, what's interesting is along with the standard model, they've long believed in this thing called supersymmetry, which postulates that there are these supersymmetric particles that are coupled with actual real particles. And a lot of people thought, well, maybe that's dark matter.
And yes, so just to clarify again, supersymmetry is this very popular theoretical extension to the standard model. Physicists need some sort of modification or addition to the standard model of particle physics, because otherwise the mathematics doesn't quite work out. And they are pretty sure that the standard model alone can't be the final answer. So they're hoping to find some evidence that supersymmetry is correct at the LHC.
Well, recent results, like really recent results within the last few weeks, have come out to say that, yeah, there's a problem with supersymmetry.
Yeah, and that's these results that came out of the LHCb experiment. So one way to look for evidence of supersymmetry is by looking at how certain heavy particles called B mesons decay and turn into other particles called muons. Following the rules of the Standard Model, there are a small number of ways in which this can happen. But if supersymmetry is true, there are more ways. So that means that if supersymmetry is correct, then you'd expect to see more B meson to muon decays than if the Standard Model alone is correct. And early results from the LHCb experiment in November, which is what you're referring to, have come down on the side of the Standard Model alone and against supersymmetry.
They have not been able to confirm something that they expected. And that, to a lot of people, puts everything back at ground zero. The other sort of tangential big news that goes along with that this year was the false neutrino results.
Oh, yes, the neutrino, the faster-than-light neutrino. There was a huge amount of fuss in 2011 when the OPERA experiment seemed to show that neutrinos can travel faster than the speed of light. That result was retracted this year after it couldn't be replicated and physicists found some faults with the equipment. It was all a bit embarrassing.
I had two things to say about that. So this goes back to my psychologist friend's comment about how he thinks, you know, all of these high energy physics results are very interesting because we're making a lot of logical deductions, a whole string of logical deductions from some very fuzzy data. And in the neutrino results, I guess there was a problem with the GPS receiver or something, that the time was wrong. But the thing is, it underscores how delicate and how tremendously complicated some of these high-energy physics experiments are, and how difficult it is to make some of these measurements, and why it's so important to make sure you absolutely have it right. And I will say that there are some new results coming out of the condensed matter physics community where they're able to repeat some of the experiments or even do new experiments that the particle physicists would need billions of dollars to do, and these guys can do it on a desktop. And I think maybe that's perhaps where some of the future in this sort of thing lies. I suspect there are fewer things that could go wrong. And I think the problem with some of these huge things like the LHC is that one little thing goes wrong, and did you find the Higgs or did you find a flea that got into your system? I mean, you don't know. You never know. So
with these sort of condensed matter tabletop experiments that you're describing there, would they be able to address the same kind of big questions in physics? And if so, would it be a case of trying to model systems or simulate them in a way, but not actually to kind of recreate events that we saw in the early universe? Or what exactly can these condensed matter experiments do?
Well, the one thing that comes to mind is related to some work that I've been doing lately, and that's there are these things that were predicted a long time ago called Majorana particles, and they are particles that are their own antiparticles. And Majorana particles have been theorized for a long time. A lot of people think maybe neutrinos might be Majorana particles, but there are some problems with that because there are some other results about neutrinos that are intriguing that suggest that maybe they're not. But some guys in condensed matter have been able to create what I would call quasi-Majorana particles. It's not just modeling them, it's actually making them. They're not fundamental particles. What they've done is they've taken an electron and they've managed to split it into two different parts, its inherent spin part and its orbital part. That's kind of weird. And in that way, it's sort of a Majorana particle in a sense. And in fact, a paper I'm working on right now would suggest that, yes, that qualifies as a Majorana particle, but it's not a fundamental Majorana particle, I guess. But I think that offers some suggestions about how it might be possible to use condensed matter physics to do things that normally might be done by a huge accelerator. I mean, these guys created this thing in a wire. Certainly, it's very sophisticated equipment, but it's not the size of the LHC and certainly is a lot cheaper. Now, could we explore the early universe this way? I don't know. I was about to say no, but you never know, because there were people who suspected you needed a big accelerator or a collider to make Majorana particles. But, you know, I think there are some very interesting things that'll come out in the coming years from condensed matter physics that might turn particle physics on its head.
So now, you know, the researchers behind the Higgs discovery might feel bad that they haven't won the Nobel Prize in physics this year. And they might feel bad that they didn't make number one on your list this year. But somebody has recognized them, and that is Yuri Milner, who has been giving out lots and lots of money this year to physics, which is great. Do you want to talk a bit about the Milner Prizes?
Sure. Hey, Yuri, I could use some money. Anyway, so Yuri Milner is an internet entrepreneur from Russia who started a prize for foundational work in physics. I guess it's my understanding that apparently he had majored in physics as an undergraduate or something like that, and he made gobs and gobs of money. And he started a prize this summer to be awarded to people. I don't really know exactly who chose the original ones. I do know that in the future, anyone can nominate someone for the Milner Prize, which I think is interesting because the Nobel Prize, there are very specific limitations on who can actually make nominations for the Nobel Prize. And the interesting thing is each award of the Milner Prize is $3 million, which is more than double the Nobel Prize is. So certainly from a monetary standpoint, of course, not everything's about money, but it's big. It's a lot of money. And just to give you an idea, he's given out more than 10 awards just this year already. So he's given out $30 million to fundamental physics in a little over 6 months. And the LHC guys did receive one. It was people actually working on three different groups at the LHC, that group and then Stephen Hawking. And so the Higgs guys won something. And I'm sure $3 million is a nice amount of money right around Christmas. So,
well, you know, here's a question about, you know, sort of giving out these large amounts of money. And, you know, we should say, you know, we absolutely love the people that have been given the awards so far. It's right up FQXI's alley in terms of research into theoretical physics and the foundations of physics. But the question is, if you're going to give out lots of money, is it, you know, the best thing to do to give it out to people who are already really established, who already have really big reputations and have done a lot of good work? You know, it's sort of, I guess, a reward for what they've done. Or should the money be being invested into sort of younger people perhaps doing new work?
That's an excellent question. And it's tough to take a stance on that. On the one hand, as someone who toils on the front lines every day, and professors don't get paid a whole lot, and there's not a whole lot of money out there for funding research in foundations. That's partly what FQXI is there to help with. It would be nice if there was some money that was put towards funding research. On the other hand, I think it's great publicity in the sense that you've got a guy who is a internet entrepreneur who is recognizing the importance of fundamental physics.
So there we have it. Number two is the discovery of the Higgs.
That would be the discovery of a Higgs-like particle. So, can you guess what's at number one? We'll return to Ian later in the podcast to find out if you're right.
In the meantime, we're having a string theory bonanza today. Next up is Joanna Kaczmarek, a string theorist at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver, who is taking a very different approach to the problem of time. String theorists already posit that elementary particles are made up of tiny vibrating threads of energy at the fundamental level. Kaczmarek is taking things a step further by asking whether space-time itself is made up of some kind of smaller building blocks, and whether the arrow of time emerges as these blocks are glued together, as she explained to reporter Corinne Pickemer.
At the University of British Columbia in Vancouver in Canada, string theorist Joanna Kaczmarek is trying to understand how the mathematical properties that underlie string theory can help us find the missing link between quantum mechanics, which describes the behavior of subatomic particles, and Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity. String theorists believe that matter is made up of minuscule vibrating loops of energy that underlie everything, and many of them presume that the four-dimensional space-time proposed by Einstein forms the fundamental stage upon which these vibrating loops and threads perform their tasks. But Kaczmarek has her doubts about this latter idea. In 2010, she received a grant from the Foundational Questions Institute to see if space-time itself is made up of even more fundamental constituents. To learn about her project and to see how far she has come in finding an answer, I caught up with Kaczmarek on Skype.
My name is Joanna Kaczmarek. I moved to Canada from Poland when I was 17. So I finished high school in Canada and I did my undergraduate at Queen's University. And then I moved to Princeton for my PhD.
When she was at Princeton University, Kaczmarek focused on understanding and applying string theory. This theory suggests that everything is made up of wiggling loops of energy that look a little like elastic bands. The different wiggle patterns or vibration frequencies of each of these elastic bands determines the unique properties of particles, such as their charge and their mass. Just like different vibrations on a violin string produce unique musical notes. One of the novel ideas around in string theory when Kaczmarek was a graduate student was the idea that string theory might depend not on normal geometry, but on what is known as non-commutative geometry.
Non-commutative geometry is just this idea that perhaps if you're looking at coordinates of, say, some particles, you know, describe, you know, one coordinate with an x-axis, another coordinate with an y-axis, and normally we treat these x's and the y's as numbers. And the idea is that maybe those things aren't actually normal numbers.
Normal or real numbers have a commutative property. This means that it doesn't matter in which order you multiply or add two numbers. The answer will always be the same. So whether I multiply 4 times 3 or 3 times 4, the answer will always be 12. But Kaczmarek wonders what it means if geometry is not commutative.
What if the coordinate that describe positions of things don't have that property? What if you multiply x times y, you don't get the same thing as y times x? How would that affect your view of geometry? And it completely changes. The whole idea of geometry basically breaks down, and you have to treat it in a very different way.
It turns out that string theory naturally contains hints of non-commutative geometry in the existence of so-called D-brains.
What people know about string theory, if they know anything, is that it's about little loops of stuff. And that really is what string theory is about on some level, is that you just say, look, maybe some elementary particles like electrons, which we normally picture as point-like, maybe if you keep magnifying and magnifying and magnifying, eventually instead of a point you see a little loop, like a rubber band. D-brains take this a step farther and say, what if you cut open this rubber band with scissors? Now you get two ends. And it turns out those ends can't just flop randomly in space. They have to get it themselves attached to something. That is what a D-brain is a place where the ends of these strings can go.
D-brains can take many dimensions and different shapes. A D-brain can be a point where both ends are stuck to the same particular point in space. Or it can be a long thread, with each end stuck along a line with frequencies running up and down them. Or it could be a sheet, or a sphere, or any other shape. It is what happens when you put them all together that changes everything.
At the same time, if you put a whole bunch of D-brains together, right on top of each other, all in the same place, they exhibit very exotic behavior, and that's where the non-commutativity comes in. So this is how it was brought into string theory originally. People realized that, well, if you put a lot of these D-brains together, the geometry that they perceive is not our ordinary geometry, but in fact a non-commutative geometry. And so that's the way in which non-commutative geometry naturally comes out of string theory.
During her PhD, Kaczmarek focused her research on the various theories that use these non-commutative properties of string theory, and she has since been on a mission to explore the different ways in which they can explain nature.
And so the project for FQXI has been partly to see whether there's a link between the existence of these kind of non-commutative structures and certain properties of time. There is some work done by other people previously that suggests that when you do the mathematics from which these non-commutative structures arise, which are mathematics of things like we call matrix models, that these matrix models have interesting properties in how time behaves in them. When you introduce these matrix models, if you make the matrices really, really large, then, for example, perhaps you can explain the existence of the arrow of time.
Einstein's theories of relativity tell us that time is another dimension, just like space. But while we can move right as well as left in space, we can't do the same with time. Events always happen in the same order. As we age, our hair turns from a colour to grey, never the other way around, and leaves fall from trees only after they have turned golden. This arrow of time is not only true for us, but also applies to everything in the universe. the direction is thought to be related to increasing entropy, a measure of the growing disorder of the universe.
And so I looked at it and I said, okay, well, if these things have in them generically the entropic arrow of time, and if I can link these matrix models to non-commutative geometry, then maybe I can see whether a generic non-commutative model naturally exhibits an arrow of time. So this would be very interesting because you could assume non-commutative geometry and then somehow get this property of time for free.
Kaczmarek is still in the early stages of her research. Together with her graduate students, she is trying to find a good model she can use to explore what non-commutative geometry means for time.
We had now looked at a number of different implementations of what are called non-commutative spheres in matrix models. And what I was hoping for is that we could find a particular implementation of a non-commutative sphere, which we could treat as an example to demonstrate that this non-commutative geometry has interesting implications for time. But first you have to find a model which has all the right features in which you can do this. And we can't find one that's what we call stable. It's not really a resolved thing whether or not these type of models are in fact stable, meaning whether if you try to build one, it wouldn't just collapse under you. So we run into a lot of technical difficulties in this nature. We're still trying to find a model in which I have the aspects of non-commutative geometry, I have the matrix aspects, I can put them together and I can ask things about time. And we've looked at a number of models, we just haven't found the right one yet.
A major aim of this project is to find a theory of quantum gravity linking general relativity and quantum mechanics, which is currently still a great mystery. Kaczmarek thinks that the answer lies in the geometry that underpins general relativity.
Every physical model starts with some small number of assumptions or a small number of elements. So you might, for example, say, okay, you know, what do particles look like? Are there points or are there loops? But if you want to have particles, you have to have something for them to move in. So you say, well, I'm going to assume that there's space. And that's certainly what general relativity does.
And this is the crux of Kaczmarek's work.
In emergent spacetime theories, you don't put that in. You say, I'm not going to assume that space exists. I'm going to put in a whole bunch of other kind of mathematical objects, none of which are geometrical, and I'm going to see whether geometry as we know it can emerge out of that mathematically. And the reason why that's interesting is because we have trouble marrying together general relativity and quantum mechanics, and that's really the whole point of string theories, trying to get these two theories together. And the reason really why we have trouble marrying them together is fluctuating geometry. And so the idea is, well, maybe fluctuating geometry doesn't actually exist. We throw it out, and we start with a fully quantum mechanical model with no geometry. And then we see whether that fully quantum mechanical model with no geometry in it contains geometry in it secretly, and hope that in that way we can avoid some of the contradictions that would have appeared if we put the geometry in to start with. If geometry is emergent, then the arrow of time, for example, is a natural consequence. You can't do one without the other. So in some sense, it's like a two-for-one deal.
While Kaczmarek is building on research by others, she is one of the few who have dared to take the step of questioning how fundamental space-time really is. One of the reasons for this, she believes, is that the research has a very high risk of not succeeding. However, most string theorists agree that if the project is successful, our understanding of nature, and perhaps especially the nature of time, would change fundamentally. But Kaczmarek is quick to point out that while her findings might have an enormous impact on the way in which we understand the world, there is no need for us to throw out all of our old theories.
It would be a sort of a paradigm shift because we would think differently about what the underlying theory is, but it wouldn't necessitate a change in how we compute many things, right? If you want to plan a mission to Mars, and you want to compute the orbit of your spaceship, you can use Newtonian mechanics. You don't do anything else. You're perfectly fine doing what Newton told you how to do. If you want to build the GPS system, it turns out you have to listen to Einstein because you need better accuracy. You really need to know where your satellites are and you really need to know how well their clocks work. So now you better have some relativity in your toolkit. But the other value of having discovered relativity is that we completely changed the paradigm in which we think about geometry. So if it turned out that this kind of emergent geometrical picture is in some way accurate, we would think very differently about our world. without actually changing how we compute most of the time. We're not trying to throw out all of current science because current science works. We're trying to get at something deeper underlying.
That was Joanna Kaczmarek speaking with Karin Pikama. And you can read more about her research on our website, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, where you'll find a link to an article about her work. Whether time is fundamental or emergent, we're almost running out of it. But we better pay one last visit to Ian Durham to find out what he thinks was the best physics story of 2012.
So to recap, at numbers 4 and 3, we had advances in quantum foundations, both theory and experiment. And at number 2, the discovery of a particle that is most probably the Higgs. Which brings us to number 1.
So this is going to be a surprise to a lot of people. So I awarded my top story of 2012 to the recent discovery of an Earth-massed planet around Alpha Centauri. That's an odd one for someone like me who's a quantum foundations guy. But as soon as the announcement came out, I said to myself, gee, I wonder if I could make a spaceship and go there. What's just amazing about this discovery is that, so Alpha Centauri is part of a star system that is the closest star system to the sun. It's not actually the closest star. The closest star is Proxima Centauri, which is in the same system. So that you've got a bunch of stars there all kind of hanging out together. Alpha Centauri is, you know, visible to the naked eye. It's the closest star system to us. It's only 4 light years away. And to find an Earth-massed planet orbiting Alpha Centauri was just like, wow. To think it's almost within reach. Almost within reach. I mean, it would take probably 40,000 years to get something there, but it's so tantalizingly close. It apparently is not in the habitable zone. It's too hot. So, you know, any plans for colonization are probably gone. But it was so inspiring that I had a number of friends on Facebook who are not scientists who just, they saw this and they were inspired. They said, let's send a probe tomorrow, you know, that kind of thing. And we probably could, you know, reach out. And like I said, it would take a very, very long time. It would require a lot of long-term thinking. Using present technology would take probably 40,000 years to get there. But, you know, for those of us who've been alive long enough to say that Voyager 1 has been out there almost my entire life, and I'm pushing middle age, we know that we can have these long-term scientific experiments in space and that they can produce really interesting and fascinating science. So it's not too far-fetched to think we could send something there, but it's tantalizing. And it really makes you wonder, geez, maybe we will get signals from another civilization. Now, speaking of really amazingly precise experiments, this required amazingly precise observations. So while experimental physicists design experiments that do something, astronomers can't do that. The best they can do is just look up and see what's there. So what they have to do is they just have to look really, really closely and carefully. But interestingly enough, the results really are similarly statistical in the sense that they're looking for very tiny little wobbles in data or light. There are lots of different ways they can find extrasolar planets, but all of them are tremendously exact measurements. I mean, it just has to be perfect in order to get that. I mean, you think about the Earth in relation to the sun. It's 100 Earths would fit across the diameter of the sun, I believe. That's massive compared to the Earth. So an Earth-massed planet near Alpha Centauri, which, you know, it's a star, so it's fairly large, to find that is incredible. I mean, that's just an incredible achievement. So that's my number one 2012 thing, is the discovery of the planet around Alpha Centauri, where I wouldn't mind going on vacation. Maybe Yuri Milner will spend some money and send me there.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ian. And I guess we'll talk to you again maybe this time next year for your update on the best physics stories of 2013. And in the meantime, you can build your spacecraft.
That's assuming we'll be here because, you know, the Mayan apocalypse is supposed to happen in about a week. So I tend not to believe in these sorts of things. But then when Hostess went out of business and I said, oh, wow, well, the Twinkie was supposed to survive the apocalypse. And now the Twinkies are gone. Maybe the apocalypse really is coming. So I don't know. Maybe this will be the one and only Ian Durham physics stories of the year. This could be the only time it happens.
And if the world does end in, you know, in a couple of weeks, I think that would have to take number one place, really, possibly ahead of a discovery of the exoplanet.
How would we know if the world did end? We'd all be dead.
That's true, yeah. Okay, on that scary note, thank you very much, Ian Durham, and goodbye. So there we have it. The discovery of a home from home, practically in our own backyard, makes the top of Ian's list. Congratulations to the team of astronomers behind the discovery. You can read more about all of the items in the countdown through links on our podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. There you'll also find an extended version of Ian's review of the year.
That's all for this podcast and for 2012. So thanks again to Ian Durham, Raphael Bousseau, Sophie Hebden, Joanna Kaczmarek, and Karin Pikama. As always, you can contact us at podcast@fqxi.org or via Twitter @fqxi. So assuming that the world doesn't end on December 21st, 2012, as the ancient Mayans may have predicted, we'll be back in 2013. In the meantime,
we wish you a Merry Higgsmas.
And a Happy New Year. She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster.